Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on the 4th of July, we'll examine the enduring gulf between the lofty rhetoric of the founding father Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence and the reality of today, where our American democracy is looking more and more like a plutocracy controlled by venal and selfish oligarchs. Alan Lichtman, a professor of history at American University and author of White Protestant Nation, joins us to analyze how much the founders were committed to participatory democracy and how much they wanted to protect property rights of the elite and deliberately make a system less responsive to the have-nots. Then we'll look further into the not-so-evident truth that all men are created equal and explore the notion of the pursuit of happiness. Stephen Schwartz, a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, joins us to discuss the extent to which we have successfully pursued happiness given our growing inequality and disparity in wealth, our global record of having the most people incarcerated, the developed world's most expensive healthcare system that produces the worst results, an epidemic of obesity, and a frayed social safety net under attack from billionaires and their political hirelings who, along with the media, are managing to persuade a lot of Americans that their happiness and well-being will be improved if they get less government services for their taxes while giving billionaire job creators more tax breaks. Joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who is a professor of history at American University, where he studies both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
My great pleasure.
And happy 4th of July to you.
Same to you and to everyone listening.
And just to touch on your prediction system, since we've spoken in the past, are you still sticking with your prediction that Barack Obama will get a second term?
Yes, my prediction, of course, is based not on just my gut, but on my system and my book, The 13 Keys to the White House. And the keys measure the fundamentals, scandal, social unrest, policy change, foreign policy, the economy. They don't change very quickly. Nothing has changed on the keys. Barack Obama should still be elected in November.
So what do you make about, though, in terms of White Protestant Nation, the boiling hatred for President Obama out there, largely amongst white males? And I don't know whether it's a growing figure, but it's certainly a vocal constituency.
It's certainly a vocal constituency. And when you look at the history of the American right, which is indeed in my book, White Protestant Nation, what you see is there's always been a segment of the American right which doesn't simply believe that the opposition is wrong. You know, the opposition is wrong on issues like abortion or aiding unions or Social Security or medical care, but rather somehow the opposition is illegitimate. It is un-American. It is ungodly. The opposition is not only sending us down the wrong path in terms of public policy, the opposition is in fact sending us to some kind of living hell. And that's exactly what you're seeing in this, what is a truly irrational hatred of Barack Obama. You know, Barack Obama has not made his race an issue. He's not made racial issues a point of his presidency. Like the first Catholic president, John F. Kennedy, he's governed as president of all the people. You might not agree with what he stands for or what he's done, but that's quite a different issue than questioning his legitimacy or calling him a socialist or a communist or even the Antichrist, questioning his legitimacy in terms of his birth, challenging him for being a Muslim. These things go far beyond normal political debate and represent this long strain on the right of looking at the opposition as illegitimate. And, of course, that is somewhat magnified with the first African-American president. It's not solely based on race, but there is a racial element to it as well.
So on this 4th of July, Alan Lichtman, I wanted to examine the enduring gulf between the lofty rhetoric of the founding father, Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, and the reality of today, where our American democracy is looking more and more like a plutocracy controlled by, I'd say, venal and selfish oligarchs, the 1% of the 1% that are trying to buy this election. Don't we have some fundamental questions to ask ourselves on this day?
Well, as you know, Thomas Jefferson himself and other upholders of liberty have said, you know, liberty requires constant vigilance. There are always those who want to turn a democratic system to their own narrow advantage and will use whatever means available, including control over great wealth. And you have to understand, you know, while it seems like huge amounts of money are being funneled into this campaign, perhaps in the effort to defeat Barack Obama, well upwards of $1 billion, perhaps even above and beyond what Governor Romney takes in, that is a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the wealth controlled by the interests making these kinds of contributions. I've said for some time, if you want to get rich in America, don't mine for gold, don't dig for oil, don't try to find uranium, make political contributions. For a few millions in contributions, these wealthy special interests can reap billions upon billions in profits. One line changed in a bill dealing with regulation or taxes or subsidies to big corporations that no one will ever notice could make a difference in many billions of dollars in the amount of money reaped by those interests. So they have extremely powerful financial incentives to try to control the political system in a way the ordinary American doesn't and really doesn't understand. And the problem is the special interests are highly mobilized and ordinary Americans are not. You know, we saw the Occupy Wall Street movement, but it never became the kind of mass political movement that we saw with the Civil Rights Movement or the anti-war movement during the 1960s and then later into the 1970s.
Again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is a professor of history at American University, where he studies both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. So, given what you just told us, Alan Lichtman, about how a handful of people can basically buy the elections and they buy the political influence that's far disproportionate to what the ordinary voter has in terms of the citizen's right to vote, it's sort of not one person, one vote anymore. It's $1, one vote. Was that ever the intention of the Founding Fathers? Because from the very beginning in our political DNA, there's questions of how much the Founders were committed to participatory democracy and property rights of the elite few. And many argue that they thought that democracies were not supposed to be able to alter or threaten those rights. And then, indeed, the Constitutional Convention was called in part because democracy was performing too well under the article. And the Founding Fathers deliberately wanted to make the system less responsive to the have-nots. So walk us through that somewhat.
It's a mixed bag. I mean, you know, kind of reading the intentions and actions of the Founding Fathers is a bit like reading the Bible. You can find in there what you want to find. There's no question that the Founding Fathers made enormous progress in establishing two critical principles. One was sovereignty of the people. Prior to the founding of the American government, the primary way, not only in the West but in most of the world, you attain rulership was either by right of birth, kingship, or by right of conquest. And the Founding Fathers said, no, that would not be the basis of rulership in America. Maybe apocryphal, but it is said, you know, at least symbolically, that George Washington denied offers to become the first American king. Instead, they said sovereignty would lie within the people and government would be a compact among the governed. The second critical thing they did was, of course, what the Declaration of Independence established, certain basic inalienable rights that were inherent to being a human being that no government could take away from you. So you've got to give the Founding Fathers those two very, very important precedents. On the other hand, the Founding Fathers loved the people, but they didn't love them all that much. They were the elites. They were, it's sad to say, the slaveholding planter elite. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, of course, were both very large slaveholders, and they were the northern merchant elite. And in many ways, they did believe that under the Articles of Confederation, government was too unruly, too subject to the whims of the people, and that was reined in with the Constitution. And even within the Constitution, there were ways of controlling the will of the people, the most obvious being, of course, the fact that our president is not directly elected, but rather is elected indirectly through the Electoral College. The Senate is not based on representation of the people. It's based upon state-by-state representation. And, of course, the suffrage was highly restricted in those days. It was essentially a white male suffrage. And in some states, at least very early on, you had suffrage restricted to property holders and to those holding certain religions. Now, to listen to some on the right, like Newt Gingrich, who actually at one time taught a course in U.S. history, say, well, these wonderful, you know, American founders and their descendants gave women the right to vote, gave blacks the right to vote. No, no one gave these basic rights. They were fought for in great struggle. Women struggled until 1920 to get full voting rights. African Americans struggled until the mid-1960s to get full voting rights and other rights in this country. And, of course, there are still lingering examples of discrimination. So the lesson is, yes, the Founding Fathers established very important principles of human rights and democracy, but they also in many ways believed in a limitation and restriction on democracy. And to defend our rights, to extend our rights, to uphold our rights requires political action and mass and often difficult political action. You know, quite a number of people died in the civil rights movement trying to achieve racial liberty, freedom, and equality in the United States.
Well, Alan Lipton, there are even more dystopian views of the Founding Fathers. There's a British historian, Eden Gately, wrote a book about tobacco that took the position that the Virginians, the big planters like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, who were huge slaveholders, that not only were slaves necessary for the growing of all the tobacco, which in many ways was a source of their wealth and fortunes, the number of slaves you had was also a badge of honor in terms of social distinction. And then some analysts go further to say that indeed the fortunes of the Founding Fathers were predicated on a drug being tobacco, and that, you know, that they initially brought over a lot of poorhouse kids from England to work the tobacco fields, and then they got sick, and so they brought in the Africans who were more resistant to malaria. I mean, that's a version. That's a pretty bleak one on it to discuss on the 4th of July.
Yeah, that's a version, and it's only part of the truth. As I said, there's other parts of the truth as well. It's easy to condemn the slaveholders for dependence on slavery and tobacco. And of course, cotton was also extremely important, especially a little later after the invention of the cotton gin. But nonetheless, you still also have to recognize the contributions of the Founding Fathers. They didn't establish an oligarchy. They didn't establish a military dictatorship. They didn't establish a kingship. They did establish the principle of sovereignty of the people, and they did establish the principle of basic human rights. So it is a mixed picture, and those who would uncritically celebrate the Founding Fathers, I think, miss part of the picture, and those who would uncritically condemn the Founding Fathers miss part of the picture as well. And I think, again, the lesson is, if you want to uphold your liberty, if you want to uphold your right to make decisions that affect you and not simply the few, you've got to become politically active. You've got to get involved. And I think there's two sides to the threats to our democracy, and you've excellently put your finger on one side, and that is the overwhelming power of money provided by a few with very special interests. But the other side is the decline of grassroots politics and grassroots political movements in this country.
Well, that's I think, something that, you know, you mentioned, Alan Lipton, a little while ago, the Occupy movement. Some people thought that maybe is the beginning of a kind of grassroots revolution here in the United States against this sort of incipient plutocracy and oligarchy that many seem to feel that is quite evident, and feel that we've lost our way as a democracy, and particularly the extent to which a handful of people trying to buy the elections, I think, brings that into stark focus. But what I find extraordinary about the Declaration of Independence is not just the oft-quoted "we hold these truths to be self-evident" part, but just a few lines down, that, you know, after that to secure these rights, governments institute amongst men deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And then this is the part that's very rarely quoted. that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Now, that's an invitation to revolution.
And indeed, Thomas Jefferson was condemned in his own time for being a revolutionary, for supporting, for example, the French Revolution. When he ran for president in 1800, he was condemned as a revolutionary, a murderer, an atheist. The opposition said that blood would run in the streets if Thomas Jefferson was getting elected. So even the oligarchs of his time recognized what a dangerous doctrine that was, you know, the idea that the fruits of revolution need to be watered from time to time by new revolutions, you know, paraphrasing. Jefferson was considered an extremely dangerous and subversive doctrine even to that time. But clearly, if you take Jefferson at face value, he establishes the principle that ordinary citizens have the right and perhaps even indeed the obligation to alter, abolish existing governments, to institute new governments that are more likely to affect their safety and happiness. So I think you're absolutely correct in saying, you know, the interests don't want you to pay any attention to that side of Thomas Jefferson.
Well, it is, as I say, you know, in schools, I think they recite the Declaration of Independence up to that point, right?
That's right. Yes. You don't hear a revolutionary doctrine being you know, proclaimed conventionally in this country. In fact, what's kind of ironic, of course, is, you know, those who would advocate that would be condemned as being un-American, as going against the founding fathers.
Again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is a professor of history at American University, where he studies both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. And on this 4th of July, we're talking about the distance between the lofty rhetoric of the founding father, particularly Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, where all men are created equal, and the current situation in terms of how far our democracy has drifted towards a plutocracy. And I guess the question then becomes, Alan, you know, we've quite often, I've talked to people about the influence of the religious right and, you know, this idea that the religious right and right-wing corporatists have taken over the Republican Party. This is no longer the party of Dwight Eisenhower. In fact, I think it was Jeb Bush who recently said that that Ronald Reagan wouldn't even be welcome in the Republican Party anymore. It has clearly become a very right-wing party, and many have argued that what the Democrats need in this country is a kind of revival of the religious left that existed under Williams Jennings Bryan in what was described as the Gilded Age. And many again have argued that we are in another Gilded Age. So to take that analogy of the need for a religious left to be revived in this country in order to overcome the religious right, do you see in terms of the constitutionalists, you know, because the right wing, the Tea Party, the Federalists in the legal system, they've all basically, and the religious right have all claimed that the Constitution is on their side, that it's a Christian document, and we're supposed to be a Christian nation, and all of that stuff that has absolutely no foundation in history. So do you think there's a possibility that there can be a kind of left-wing constitutionalist movement?
Well, I absolutely think you really asked me two questions. One, can there be kind of a religious movement on the left? And I think absolutely. There's certainly ample historical precedent for it, one of which you pointed out was William Jennings Bryan, who was a powerful evangelical Christian and the most progressive advocate of his time, who really helped transform Democratic Party of Grover Cleveland into the Democratic Party of Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, which is so fundamentally different. And let's not forget the Civil Rights Movement to great extent, was inspired within the African-American church in the United States, and powerful religious impulses moved the civil rights organizations and leaders. So there's no question that there is a history for a movement from the left inspired by religion. No one political ideology, no one group has a monopoly on the Bible, on religious doctrine, or on the religious spirit. And certainly there are very different readings of our religious tradition that would suggest very different kinds of policies. I mean, if you read the Bible carefully, actually read what's in the Bible, things that the religious right stress, like punishment for homosexuals, is barely mentioned in the Bible, is never mentioned by Jesus. And yet economic justice redounds throughout the Bible, you know, by huge orders of magnitude, vastly more important than those things that the religious right harp upon. So I certainly think that there is a real possibility for revival in that direction. And what was your second question now?
Well, the second question is that is there, just as there's a need for a revival of a religious left,
the Constitution. Yeah.
There's also a need, I think, for a revival of a leftist interpretation of the Constitution, which is largely favors them, just as the Bible favors the religious left.
Absolutely. I think there's a very powerful argument that the Founding Fathers meant the Constitution to be a living document. After all, they did provide various provisions for amending the Constitution. The Constitution has been amended, of course, you know, quite a few times. And, you know, one of the most important amendments is the 14th Amendment, which unfortunately I think has been hijacked by this whole idea of corporate personhood, that somehow the right is vigilant and vehement in defending the rights of persons as corporations, which I think is a very dubious reading of the 14th Amendment, you know, done by a very pro-business court in the 19th century, and by nowhere concerned with the human rights, you know, the principle of equal protection under the law, which is so critical and such an important element of, I think, our jurisprudence and our traditions. And I think in the 14th Amendment and other amendments, as well as the powers and rights set forth in the Constitution, there is room for a very progressive reading of the Constitution and for a progressive constitutionalist movement. And by the way, the right wing is certainly not chary of attacking the Constitution and its legal interpretation when it doesn't suit them. Look at the vehement attack on what is established under the 14th Amendment, and that is the children of undocumented immigrants born on American soil are American citizens. They don't like that, and suddenly their constitutionalism vanishes in the wind.
Well, just in closing, Alan Lichtman, given how few Americans vote compared to the number that are eligible, and yet, you know, as we mentioned earlier, African Americans didn't really get their rights till 1965, and Latinos are in many ways a sleeping giant in this country, but many have not become citizens who are residents, and there's still an awful lot that haven't registered to vote. What explains the lack of interest in the lack of connection? Because we're talking about the very document, the Constitution and the Founding Fathers, that many see in the rest of the world see as a great inspiration, yet Americans are very reluctant to go to the polls and participate in their own democracy.
And you got to understand, for the wealthy special interest, limited democracy is very much a priority for them. After all, consider what's going on in conservative states, attempts to suppress and restrict suffrage by stringent and needless photo voter ID laws and other means. Secondly, I think you need to look at some of the evidence from the last 40 or 50 years of surveys. Americans have lost confidence in their government. You know, back when John Kennedy was president, three-quarters of the American people thought, yes, government does most of the time work in the interests of ordinary folk like me. Now only about 25% think of that. So people really don't believe that government operates in their interests, and I think they are discouraged in that they don't think there's very much they can do about it. And so there's a tremendous amount of indifference, leaving aside the institutional barriers to voting, which are in the interests of the special interests and much, much too high in this country. I think underlying that is this other crisis of confidence.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alan Glickman.
My great pleasure. Take care.
You too. And happy 4th. Again, I've been speaking with Alan Glickman, who is a professor of history at the American University, where he studies both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back exploring the notion of the pursuit of happiness.
About freedom. When you're trying to be free, they never let you. They said it's easy, nothing to it. And now-